Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science. I'm Maya Wollner, your podcast host today. This afternoon, I have the real pleasure of speaking with Dr. Hervé Guimant about his recent book, Schizophrenics in the 20th Century, The Side Effects of History, published in French by ALMA in 2018. In 2006, Dr. Guimant published a comparative history of therapeutic and religious practices. In 2010, he published a book called The Coué Method, which is a fascinating exploration of an early form of self-help. In 2013, with Stéphane Tisson, he co-authored From the Front to the Asylum, 1914 through 1918, which was also published by ALMA. Hello, Dr. Guimant. It's great to have you on New Books in Science.
Thank you for having me.
So let me start by asking you, what inspired you to write this book?
I know for a few years, my work is about to write a social history of medicine, psychology, and psychiatry, and more particularly, my aim is to reveal the birth and the disappearance of practices, diseases, and institutions in relationship with this field, medicine and psychiatry. And in this book, my goal is to analyze why and how schizophrenia emerged. But I wanted to write differently from what we see usually, I mean. And in my opinion, schizophrenia isn't only a scientific concept. It's rather a social fact. And a social fact which has to be depicted not only from the point of view of the scientists, but in priority from the point of view of patients. So the inspiration, I think, came from first a deeper look at the archives. Secondly, a contemporary question that urged the historian to stir up the past, and thirdly, the special point of view of the writer, of course, and in my case, the desire to write history of madness from below, and I assume my bias position. Firstly, about the archives. My former book, as you said, was about the soldiers admitted in the asylum during the World War I. And I was reading the patient files, and I observed some of them being relabeled with the new diagnosis of schizophrenia. And in a sense, I saw the birth of a new mental illness in the archives of the 20s and the 30s. And at the same time, in our time, I mean, I was hearing the voices of people who wanted to abolish the notion of schizophrenia. Researchers were more and more skeptical about this concept, schizophrenia. Social actors also were very critics against stigmatization of schizophrenic, and also patients who claim that hearing voices is normal. So it was quite weird for me. I witnessed the agony of the mental illness. I was observing the birth in the archives and an illness baptized at the beginning of the 20th century and contested to death at the beginning of our century. It was, to me, a perfect object of study for an historian, of course.
Thank you so much for that. And I wanted to know, before we get into any further details, if you could explain to our listeners why you looked at three different categories, namely schizophrenia, dementia praecox, and hebephrenia.
Yeah, you know, I was searching for my patient zero, in a sense, the patient zero of schizophrenia, and I looked for three diagnoses that depicted all of them a form of juvenile psychosis. From the point of view of the patient file, these terms are totally, completely interchangeable. On the contrary to history of medical classification, which distinguishes very clearly the three terms. So three terms. First, dementia praecox. It was a term from the German science, from the Emil Kraepelin's work in the 1890s, and it depicted an early psychosis, a kind of never-ending deterioration of a young person. Schizophrenia was a term created by Eugen Bleuler a few years later to describe the same symptoms, but more emphasizing the split personality of the schizophrenic. And thirdly, hebephrenia is the same thing, but that concerns more precisely the youngest, you know, the adolescent. And I'm going to use the three terms without distinction.
That makes a lot of sense, since it seems like practitioners were also using them in that kind of way to describe similar symptoms. So today, schizophrenia has entered our popular culture. We most frequently think of it as a chronic mental illness that primarily affects young men. But I was wondering if you could explain to us how and why did this medical terminology enter into French medical discourse at the beginning of the 20th century? And also, who were the individuals who were initially diagnosed with it?
It's a big question, and I want perhaps to divide it into two parts. Firstly, how the diagnosis entered the French classification. I could say it wasn't easy to integrate in France, and it took a lot of time. And France has always been a special country for a lot of things, as you know, but especially in the history of classification, there was a strong, very strong clinical tradition in France. There is a strong clinical tradition in France. And when dementia praecox spread all over the world, there was a lot of debates in France and a lot of resistance against the German term, not only for nationalistic reasons, more certainly for ideological or medical reasons. And in medical congress at the beginning of the 20th century, some French psychiatrists argued against the borrowing of a very tragic denomination, dementia praecox. Could they cure a young person that would be labeled with this terrible term, dementia praecox? So the controversy revealed a kind of politics of classification. And to classify, in my opinion, it's a political act. Concerning the second part of your question about the individuals who were initially diagnosed like that as schizophrenic in the 20s or in the 30s, I think they didn't have a lot of symptoms in common. But the most interesting in my point of view is that they shared a same social condition. They could be considered as the losers of the modern era. They are those who couldn't respond to the expectation of school massification, military service, or not to mention expectation coming from their families. So, in other words, they were those who escaped the selectionist model born at the end of the 19th century. They weren't considered as idiots. They were, on the contrary, in a social uprising. But in the 20s, in the 30s, because precisely of the social crisis, because of wars, they failed totally. And to explain this, I would like to quote Philip K. Dick, one of my favorite authors, and in his exegesis, he gave a short definition for schizophrenic. That is, for me, a good one. Let me quote the sentence. "The schizophrenic is a leap forward that failed." And my archives, dating from the 20s and the 30s, prove that.
Thank you so much. I wanted to know if you could go a little bit deeper into this group of people, and in particular, talk a little bit about the women who were diagnosed with dementia praecox in this period. And then maybe you could also talk about sexual orientation afterwards.
Yeah, you know, it was a big surprise for me. I noticed that among those who were marginalized by society and psychiatry as schizophrenics, three-fourths were women. And I was surprised because in my mind, and probably yours also, I imagined schizophrenia being universal construct. But it wasn't. And in my corpus, in my archives, I found a lot of women who had lived in harsh social conditions, hoping for emancipation. They were maids, for instance, moving towards a better place, towards big towns. And I can quote a letter I want to share with you. It's from a woman I rename Sophie, and she explained, "I don't want to clean up the dust of men anymore. I want to be a heroine. And why not to become a typist?" And typist was her hopeful condition in the 20s. So emancipation was the big term for her. Emancipation wasn't the only thing. They also, in my opinion, they also betrayed their gender. They were frequently identified by their boyish features. And about these women, I would like to cite also the first psychiatrist who depicted the juvenile psychosis, the dementia praecox in France. His name is Jules Christian. He wrote about dementia praecox that it was, I quote, "the steep price to pay for the desire of women's emancipation." And I think that in this case, medical science is the other name for social prejudice.
That's really powerful. Thank you so much. I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about the debate between those who supported Emile Kraepelin and those French psychiatrists who did not.
As I said just a few minutes ago, there was a big controversy at the beginning of the 20th century, and especially between French and German psychiatrists, but also a controversy between French psychiatrists themselves, controversy around the existence of a specific juvenile psychosis, controversy around the number of people with the diagnosis of juvenile psychosis, around also the origins of the disease and around the way of curing. So within French psychiatry, the opposition was very drastic. A few psychiatrists declared that dementia praecox was massive, dangerous, not incurable, and it was a kind of a tragic condition. On the other hand, others, psychiatrists, contested this representation and defined a small, curable, and non-specific illness. So, in a way, this controversy was about the confrontation between a pessimistic and an optimistic manner to depict madness. And nowadays, you know, a lot of people want to rehabilitate the schizophrenic. And it would be, I think, in their interest to return to the beginning of the story, to see in which social context it was born.
What was the most interesting fact that you discovered by conducting a demographic or spatial study of the schizophrenia diagnosis in France, while also considering it within the context of the crisis of migration in the 1930s?
Schizophrenia is nowadays frequently thought as a universal, kind of eternal thing. That is quite depressing for an historian. And fortunately, I was surprised to discover a map dating from 1948, a map created by Paul Civadon. A psychiatrist working for World Health Organization. And this map was about the representation, the spatial distribution of different forms of madness in France. That was made up with statistics and given by, you know, psychiatric wards and psychiatrists. And there was a map about schizophrenia. And it appears clearly that schizophrenia, just after the Second World War, was a southern illness. And you know what is very interesting about this, about the Civadon's hypothesis, it was that madness was in the air, especially caused by the strength of the winds. And in France, we name the winds, the Mistral, la Tramontane, etc. And curiously, according to some psychiatrists, schizophrenics should be protected from these strong winds. Of course, the historian that I am thinks differently. And to discover the real origin of madness in the south of France, I went into the archives of a southern town, Montpellier, to understand from where this over-representation came from. And what I discovered was completely different. The people who were diagnosed with dementia praecox, with schizophrenia, weren't born in the territory close to Montpellier Asylum. They were from Corsica. And until 1974, there wasn't any psychiatric ward in Corsica. So when a person turned mad, he or she was placed in a temporary jail, then transferred by boat, and they were shipped off to France. And you can probably imagine the result of that process. A few days in a boat, you don't speak a word of French. Of course, you're going to be labeled as completely crazy and lost for science and medicine. And the name to, de- picked that was dementia praecox, schizophrenia. They just had to endure harsh conditions. In a sense, schizophrenia wasn't the products of nature, wasn't the products of winds, but the product of administration. And along the same lines, I discovered in one of the psychiatric institutions I worked on, more than half of schizophrenic in the 30s were immigrants. And we have to remember the French situation just after World War I. There was a high demand for labor. A lot of men, a lot of women came from other countries in the 20s, especially from Eastern Europe and Central Europe. And they were called over to work. And I was surprised to observe another representation of these new immigrants in my corpus of schizophrenic. Nowadays, psychiatrists are used to establishing a relationship between schizophrenia and migration, but in my opinion, the relationship that could be established between the two things is more social. And for sure, their migrants' hope was crushed during the 30s. There was no work anymore for these new immigrants. They were under pressure also of xenophobic discourse, and especially from French doctors in the 30s. And finally, they were prioritized to be transferred to new institutions of relegation. And in my opinion, they were victims of history.
This discovery seems really relevant, actually, to those practicing psychiatry today, and it also connects back to what you were saying previously about the leap forward that failed, that connects those populations together. So in Chapter 5, you spend some time discussing how families described their ill family members. What kind of new information did these family narratives reveal to you as a historian?
Actually, it is important, in my opinion, to reintroduce in the narrative the discourse of the patient, but also the discourse of families on madness. And it's possible thanks to the questionnaires which were filled out by families when their patients were admitted to the hospital. Of course, families answered the close question of doctors, but there wasn't enough space for them, for their words, for their stories. So a kind of flood of words were coming from these questionnaires in the margins, especially in free letters. If we compare the two narratives from the families and from the doctors, they didn't really match up. Take, for instance, the manner they depicted the beginning of madness. In the family discourse, there was always an inaugural moment give birth to madness, you know, a day, a night, frequently in relationship with history. History with a big H, wars, for instance. On the contrary, in the psychiatric discourse, the roots of evil are to be found in the past, in the childhood of the patient, or even before the birth of the patient. The degeneration is the big cause of madness for the doctors. No, probably no one's wrong, no one's right, but each actor in the story build a narrative about illness. And I think the historian must take them all into account.
I found your discussion of adolescence and puberty especially rich. How did this transitional phase from childhood to young adulthood become, quote, one of the most dangerous moments in one's life from the standpoint of schizophrenia?
Yeah, it's the meeting point of all the discourses. Schizophrenic are considered as imperfect pubescent. Everybody agrees with this idea. Psychiatrists are searching for the trace of the disease in the blood of their patients. Families are asserting that the problem is in the blood. And patients also are searching for a few means to correct their impure blood. So the main thing to understand, I think, is that dementia praecox was built to depict how young people couldn't deal with their puberty. That was thought as a biological chaos, an event that provoked a risk, the biggest risk in life. And psychiatry, in my opinion, contributed in constructing the adolescence phase as the riskiest moment in life. The problem was that everybody could be vulnerable. There was no clear boundaries between a normal pubescent and an abnormal one. And logically, scholars began to depict the fine line between a normal adolescence and a schizophrenic one. For instance, if a young person loved without reasons, he could be diagnosed as a schizophrenic. And there was a spectrum of behaviors that overlapped to describe both adolescence and schizophrenia. It was what a scholar named in the 40s the juvenile original crisis. And in my opinion, schizophrenia contributed to the medicalization of the youth and to a more negative image of adolescence.
Did the rise of evidence-based medicine, as appropriated by French psychiatrists, influence the ways in which the patient experienced their diagnosis? And if yes, how? And I want to know also a little bit about the ways in which doctors treated and measured and analyzed the schizophrenic body.
Schizophrenia was the result of psychiatrist's desire to build a real medical science at the end of the 19th century. And before this period, they were frequently considered as, philosophers, not really as scientists. During the 19th century, their aim was to distinguish mental illnesses as separated entities and to find also specific signs independent from the words of the patients, because the patient could lie. And they have to go beyond the words of the patients. So the patient became an object of science, and a scientific object. The young psychiatrists were taught to identify the schizophrenic at first look without listening, for instance, to their delusions, even if evidence-based medicine didn't exist as a term at this time. Probably the same way of thinking already existed. And that affects, of course, the patient life.
So you write in chapter 8 about the relationship between the idea of degeneration, melancholy, and the dementia praecox diagnosis. And I wanted to know if you could explain their relationship further for our listeners.
Between melancholia and schizophrenia. When I was immersed in the archives, I was interested in the transition between hysteria, melancholia, and schizophrenia. In the case of patients who were admitted in asylum for decades, I observed frequently this lexical transition. And two things are interesting in my opinion. First, rather than considering schizophrenia as an absolute beginning in history, I think it's possible to consider schizophrenia as the last stage in the long history of melancholia, which dating, as you know, from ancient history. Secondly, I think that we could think how being relabeled as this affects the patient identity and the patient image in society and family. And I want this work on labels and their long historical chain to be a contribution to the thoughts about the social construction of madness, and without a doubt to a more skeptical use of these labels.
How did opposition or resistance become one of the defining signs of schizophrenia? And what do you think that this tells us about its use as a diagnostic category?
One of the terms that appeared to define schizophrenia in my archives, in the patient files, was resistance. And schizophrenic patients were considered as negative people with nihilistic behaviors. And according to me, two reasons could explain why they were so resistant. First, as we saw just before, schizophrenic were a group of individuals that remains not understood. Society doesn't know what to do with them. Like the demonic possession in the 17th century or hysteric people in the 19th century. They are what a society couldn't understand or couldn't integrate, if you will. Secondly, they were resistant because of the manner the psychiatric institution treated them. From the point of view of scientists, history of treatments means history of progress. But from the point of view of schizophrenic patients, it's not the same history because they were considered as non-curable. They had to go through all of treatments as possible, and they were always physically aggressive for the body, as they were considered as guinea pigs. As experimental objects, they reinforced themselves as rebels. Rebellion against society, rebellion against family, rebellion against doctors, treatments, and institutions. And this resistance achieved to define schizophrenia a resistant disease. That's for this reason, in my opinion, that lobotomy was used in priority on schizophrenic patients in the 40s and in the 50s, and especially on women, because psychosurgical practice put an end to the resistance. It was the last resort to reduce the number of non-curable mad people.
Thank you. That seems like a very insightful analysis of the use of lobotomy during that period. I wanted to know, why were individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia and dementia praecox transferred in such significantly large numbers from Paris to private institutions like Saint-Rémy?
Yeah, the story of Saint-Rémy is emblematic of how schizophrenic people were treated in the first half of the 20th century, and it was a surprise to me. Let me explain the story. I was looking at the people diagnosed with schizophrenia in the Maison Blanche Asylum. It was a big institution for women in Paris. And a detail caught my attention. A lot of these patients were transferred at the end of the 30s towards psychiatric institutions I didn't even know of their existence. That piqued my interest. Of course, The transfer of patients existed in the 19th century. But here, what was unbelievable was they were transferred massively, quickly, and in new institutions conceived especially for them. And I wanted to initiate an investigation about these transfers and the institution of Saint-Rémy. So I put on my detective hat. I drove east towards an isolated low mountains where thousands of people were sent away in 1937. And what I discovered was incredible. Parisian authorities decided in the 30s to put a new system in place to deal with mad people who were more and more numerous in the Parisian asylum. They had a deal with a capitalist named Justin Perchaud, who organized very quickly an asylum at Saint-Rémy. The nurses were Spanish from the Civil War. The director was a World War I veteran. It was a cheap institution built to make money off madness. The French press attacked him on that point, but mad people were transferred in groups of 50 by train, by bus, in an adapted institution. And finally, I came up with this conclusion. Paris, the capital, got rid of the mad from the town. And chronic patients, especially schizophrenic women and immigrants, were mistreated, isolated, and led to death just before World War II.
Thank you so much for that. I want to finish our interview by asking you, what was the most surprising or unlikely thing that you discovered while conducting your research for this book?
This book was based on surprises. Every single chapter opens up with a surprise, and my method could be summarized as this: dive deep in the archives and let the surprise come to me. That's not common in the academic field, I think, but in my opinion, that produces, you know, a lot of results. And among these surprises that filled all the book, I can talk about the last chapter, if you want, the last chapter, which leads us to our present state. In the patient files, dating from the 60s and the 70s, I discovered little calendars that were marked every 3 weeks. They were the traces of the beginning of our way to deal with chronic patients with the help of medication and especially long-lasting injection. And actually, in the 50s, there was a new big problem, you know, born from a hope to cure madness in the community with medication. And in the 60s, actually, schizophrenic patients were released massively with the help of a new generation of drugs. But at the same time, chronic patients recovered a newly founded freedom. In the hospital, they hid their pills, they threw their medication on the ground, but outside, they were free to manage with it. They became drug evaders. Don't forget that frequently they couldn't tolerate the side effects of the medication. That was the problem. How to allow the patient to live, but also to be assured that they would take the medication. So the discovery in the archives was about the birth of the new system of cure. The long-lasting injection created in the 60s kept the patient tied to the hospital. The chemical restraints attached the patient to a leech. It's a strong term, but I think it's a fact. This practice is considered as normal in our time, but in the 70s, it provoked a lot of debates about, medical restraints. So the patients were stuck between autonomy and restraint. So it highlights the existence of a kind of schizophrenic institution, and ironically, it could be another side effect of history.
That seems like a great place to end, Dr. Guimau. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for your time. It was my pleasure.
And we're all hoping that your book gets translated into English very soon. And for those of you who can read French, the original title is Schizophrène au XXe siècle, des effets secondaires de l'histoire. This has been New Books in Science, and I'm Maya Wollner. Thank you for listening.